Hello and welcome to Plymouth Beneath the Surface, where we will meet inspiring people from Plymouth that have oriented their lives and careers around the ocean. Are you ready to dive into Plymouth waters to explore career options, discover underwater ecosystems, understand marine research and conservation initiatives? I'm your host, Ruza Sihan, a final year student in marine biology at the University of Plymouth. I'm really grateful to have you here today, and I hope you enjoy this dose of inspiration in this new episode. Welcome to this new episode of the podcast, and I'm with Paul Naylor. Welcome, Paul.
Thank you, Louise.
Can I ask you to introduce yourself, please?
Oh, I'm Paul Naylor. Well, first and foremost, I think of myself as a marine biologist, and I'm also an underwater photographer and filmmaker now, I guess.
What has been your career path?
Oh, I've always been passionate about marine animals. I've always loved watching marine animals and I love sharing knowledge about them. It's been quite varied because I came to the MBA, the Marine Biological Association in Plymouth, as soon as I left school. I worked for a year there, fell in love with Plymouth, wanted to come back. I then went to do my degree at Liverpool, which was one of the sort of top marine biology places then. I actually didn't do, in the end, a third year of marine biology on the Isle of Man, like I set out to do. But I did get hold of a marine project, so I could stay in Liverpool, and I did this project looking at the mussels in a disused dock, a mussel farm, which was actually wonderful. Sounds not good, but it was wonderful. And then, having got into mollusks, I then fallen under their charm. I came back to Plymouth to do my PhD, looking at uptake of metal pollutants by bivalve mollusks. And then, just as I was finishing my PhD, and this shows sort of how you're buffeted by events, really, the Thatcher government was in, cutting science a lot, cutting sort of pure science budgets. So it was really difficult to get work as a biologist, sort of in marine ecology, fields like that. And Chernobyl happened. And suddenly, there were lots of jobs looking at the movement of radioactivity in the environment. And coincidentally, I'd used radioactive tracers in my PhD to study metal uptake. So I sort of exchanged the difficult world of getting a research work for steadier work in marine environmental protection. And I have various jobs in that and ended up in the Environment Agency, being an inspector of nuclear sites for environmental regulations, which was very interesting, fascinating job, challenging, but it felt a long way away from watching marine animals. So during all that time, I kept up my sort of passion through underwater photography and sort of engagement through articles and books and a sort of parallel career, really, and kept me very busy. And then about 18 months ago now, I retired from the Environment Agency, so I'm doing marine education and so on full-time, which is wonderful to have a bit more time.
Yeah, so what's your daily life at the moment? Like, how would you describe what you do?
I suppose anything to do with sharing or showing people just what amazing marine life there is around Britain. I'm really just love studying and animals that are close and that you can keep on seeing. So mixture of, well, diving and snorkeling when I can, and the conditions are good. Doing photography, editing, making films, doing social media, doing talks, which unfortunately have to all be by Zoom at the moment. Writing articles, contributing to books, doing all sorts of things, really. But anything that tells people about marine and their stories and their behavioural stories, and doing research based on that, on behaviour as well.
So are you still doing research as well?
Yes, absolutely. Particularly on blennies and on their social lives, but also, yeah, other animals that you can study, you know, in the wild easily and find out about their behaviour.
Can you tell us a bit more about the blennies and their behaviour?
Yeah.
And tell people,
I could go on and on.
And tell people what blennies are as well.
Okay, well, blennies are small fish. Group of small fish. People are probably most familiar with the shanny, which is also called the common blenny. And if you go to any sort of rocky beach around Britain and you see a little browny green fish darting away from you, you know, 9 times out of 10 that will be one of these shannies or common blennies. The tompot blenny, which is the one I mean, I love shannies, but tompot blennies are my particular thing. They are the sort of go faster cousins. They're a bit more brightly coloured. They live a little bit deeper. You can find them at the bottom of the shore in rock pools, but more often they're in crevices below that that you have to snorkel or dive to see. And they have these amazing pair of head tentacles, and they are very charismatic, very photogenic. But for me, the most amazing thing about them is that not only are they territorial, but the patterns on their skin makes them individually recognisable with certainty from close-up photographs. So in an area of reef, you can get to know individuals and study them. And although, and that sounds sort of quite sort of whimsical, being able to do that, but it's actually scientifically very powerful, being able to recognise the same individual year on year and know what, for a start, gender is quite difficult to identify in blennies. So, but once you can identify an individual and you identify its gender once, if you like, you then know whether you're looking at a male or female when they interact, because they have incredibly complicated social lives, because the male does an awful lot of egg care. It has a territory, guards like most blennies, it guards eggs laid by the female. So it puts a lot of effort in, a lot of resource. And because it puts a lot of effort in, it means it's choosy. And females are choosy, of course, because they have a big resource, they lay the eggs. So, and where you have both genders very choosy about who they get together with, then it gets complicated. And both are promiscuous, both have multiple partners. Males host lots of females. Females visit lots of different males. So you've got this scene where they're promiscuous, but they are choosy as well. And where you have that, and both partners equally choosy, it just, you know, anywhere in the animal kingdom where you have that set up, it's complicated. And we've got that right on our doorstep, so it's great to watch it.
So do you get to recognise individuals and know them?
Yeah, absolutely. They have individual characteristics and different ways of behaviour. I mean, there's some wonderful work being done here by Mark Briffer, showing, you know, how animals like hermit crabs and sea anemones have what you could call a personality, because it's a behavioural trait that's ongoing. You know, if a sea anemone can have a personality, then blennies certainly can. And they are quite intelligent as well and territorial. And some are notably bolder than others. For example, some, you know, when you approach with camera, they'll stay hidden away. Others will zoom out onto the little shelf outside their crevice and do this sort of intimidating display, or what they call displaying prowess, where they rip up bits of seaweed with their mouths and spit them out. And this is all part of showing how tough they are. And that isn't my imagination, because they do that too. You can see them do exactly that to other blennies approaching the crevice. So this is part of their displaying dominance in their territory. And they treat my camera like another, you know, intruding blenny.
Yeah, I remember in first year when I had a talk with you, you were talking about this story of the blenny. Can you tell us about this particular blenny?
Well, it was one of the first ones that we got very interested in, called Benny.
Benny the Blenny.
And in the scientific literature, he's whatever, WB, what, Wembley Bay 1, or, you know, because we've reported scientifically as well. And we got to know him for quite a few years, and it inspired Teresa, to our wife, to write a children's book based on his life, Benny the Blenny. And it's nice because it's sort of based on, for children, but it's, you know, it's biologically true, because it's about a real fish and it's based on photographs, not cartoons. And when you talk about his neighbours, and, you know, it's actually accurate, that's what he's doing. And one of the funniest things was when Teresa had finished the book, it had been produced, it was her idea to take one of the first copies down to show the real fish. And we took it down, and I thought, what? Weird idea. And he was there, and he actually came out to see the book, because he's so territorial. And so I've got these photographs of Benny looking at his book. And when I talk, because I do quite a lot of talks, not just to biology students, but to business groups who, you know, the sort of who have speakers in. And some of them sort of start cold about the subject. You know, some talk about fish and they want to know about business or so on. And even if they don't get interested in the stories about dog whelks drilling and all that sort of thing, then the stoniest face will melt when they see a fish coming out to look at his book. And you always get a laugh from that. That's lovely.
Do you think it's important to spend that much time in the environment with these organisms to actually really grasp their behaviour and understand more of their biology?
Yes, I think so. I mean, it's another way of doing it. And it's only doing that that you know actually what goes on in the wild. I mean, obviously, even the behavioural studies I do, I worry that my presence is affecting them. But I think you've got to be there to have a chance. Because if you imagine, if they've got a complex social life, and sometimes people say, well, couldn't you set all this up in a tank? But if you imagine, however well you replicated a reef in a tank, it would be like, I mean, and this is the argument I've used, is that it would be like studying the social life of people by getting sort of random people off the street and sticking them in a prison and say what you studied there, as in Big Brother, would apply to the social life of people, and you couldn't do that. So I think you need to do it. Obviously, lab studies have their place as well. You need to do both. But you certainly need to do some behavioural observation.
Do you have any favourite species?
Other than Tom Pot Lennies, obviously. But, I mean, cuttlefish are wonderful to watch. Fabulous and sort of multi-skilled. The shore crab is a real favourite, Carcinus, because it was the animal I first saw when I started snorkelling on the Norfolk coast when I was a teenager. And, I mean, it wasn't like when I came down here, I thought it was sort of like Christmas snorkeling in the clear water here. But Norfolk, you could still see when it was clear in the sandy lagoons. But the animal you saw mainly was shore crabs. And you could see them doing their things, you know, digging up worms and grabbing mates and having disputes. And it was watching animals in their natural environment, as well as being immersed in seawater, which I loved, which sort of, well, just got me into marine biology. So they have a place, and animals like the dog whelk. You know, I'm beginning to be really fascinated by, you know, the way it drills and the way it has different preferred prey in different areas, and the fact that because if it's life story, you can have very localized natural selection and evolution. So different populations have different characteristics. All those sorts of things. So the more you learn about animals, the more amazing they are. I mean, yeah, just yesterday, I was writing an article for a diving magazine about one of the pipefish, the deep-snouted pipefish, and I looked up to see if there was, you know, what I could find about their biology. And it was amazing what work had been done. For example, you know how pipefish, the female lays her eggs in the male's belly pouch, and then they develop into miniature pipefish, and the male sort of gives birth, if you like. But in this pipefish, deep-snouted, they'd found that the baby pipefish will actually return to the pouch when danger threatens. They'll come back, and I'm not sure if that's been found in other species, but certainly distinctive in this species. And again, they've done work on the courtship, and again, it's a case with them. Because the male invests a lot looking after the young, he's very choosy about the females, and females are choosy about the males. And all sorts of things going on. And the female likes mating with big males, because big males have better brooding characteristics. But if she has to make do with a substandard male, a small male is not as good, she compensates by laying eggs with more protein when she's mating with smaller males. And this is a pipefish that I'd never looked at before. So I think, very long-winded way of saying that I think whatever animal you study, you will find
amazing
things about it, especially in the sea, and especially around here, because, you know, if you look at Blenny's, say, the tropical species are far better studied than our species. So I think whatever you do here, you'll just find these amazing things.
So how long have you been diving for?
Diving since about mid-80s, so early 80s, so that's quite a long time, isn't it? But I've been snorkeling longer than that, and I love snorkeling.
Have you seen some sort of impact through time over these 40 years? Have you seen more pollution or declining populations of some species, or not really?
Yeah, seen some declines of fish overall, seen more siltation, more plastic pollution. But I think it's really difficult on one person's observations because you look for things, and so you find them if you look for them. So I think that's why I always say, when people ask me that, that's why the recording schemes are so important, and things like Sea Search, you know, the schemes for divers where a lot of data is collected from a lot of people, are brilliant and really important.
What are your favourite places in England or around the southwest to go diving? Is it Wembury?
Well, Wembury is. I mean, Wembury is wonderful for all sorts of reasons. It's got habitats. But the main reason I love Wembury so much is because I can go there a lot. I can snorkel there. And I think anywhere you can keep going back to, again, and see the same places and even the same individual animals, you find out more. So in a way, a beach that I find, I keep going back to, and no, I just find so much more rewarding diving there than turning up on a tropical reef. When I used to dive a lot abroad, sort of early on in my diving career, and you end up on a reef, and it's fantastic. You know, you see all these amazing, colourful fish swimming around, but you don't know, you might not even know what species they are. You certainly don't know the individuals. So although it's very pretty and looks nice, it's not as engaging. And also I love the whole aspect of showing people what's there. And British marine life is so underappreciated. And somewhere like Wembley, sometimes I come out just from snorkeling with a little, you know, my compact camera. And people say, this was before the sort of social distancing, but, you know, people would say, oh, what have you been photographing? And I'd say, oh, that one is colourful fish, and they'd look at me and think, he's sort of been in there and it looks a bit murky. And then I'd show them, you know, on the screen on the back of the camera, close up of a tompot blenny or corkwing wrasse, and they'd go, what was that in there? And you'd say, yeah, just out by that rock. And they'd just be blown away by that. And then their attitude to the beach and the sea changes. And that's ultimately what we want, is people to know what's there and look after it.
How important do you think emotions are in terms of protecting marine life?
I think very important, because you need both. You know, you need, obviously people need the facts and the science, but emotions are important, because it's emotion that'll get you to do things like, you know, join beach cleans or importantly support sustainable fishing, you know, use your purchasing power. It's going to be emotion that drives that. So it's hugely important to have emotion and knowledge both.
So is it what you're trying to trigger with your photos?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's not only are people very surprised by the colours, but when you can tell behavioural stories, people love them, and it helps them engage with animals, and not even just, you know, obviously charismatic animals like blennies, but animals like limpets. You know, people see them on the rocks, and probably sometimes you have to tell kids, you know, don't just sort of kick them off. But when you tell people about the way they navigate, shake off dog whelks and stamp on starfish tube feet and that sort of thing, people think, oh, that's amazing. And in fact, I was looking for an email the other day for something else, and I found someone after a talk had said, I'll never look at limpets in the same way again in their email, or I'll look at limpets with a whole lot more respect. And I think, oh, well, that's, you know, if that's the only thing that came out of that talk, that was good.
Yeah, in the last episode, I've got Louise Firth.
Oh, right,
and
yeah.
She studied limpets. And
she's, oh, of course she did, yeah.
Yeah, and she, yeah. As she said, she's trying to raise the flag for limpets.
Right.
Because people don't really appreciate.
No.
And as you said, marine life in Britain is really underappreciated. How come do you think people don't know about marine life?
I think it's just a bit more difficult to see, obviously, than terrestrial life. And also, it's very dependent on conditions. So people snorkeling, you know, if they go somewhere abroad, they can turn up at the beach day after day, every day, go down after, you know, have wonderfully clear water here. You know, they might have a week when it's, you know, murky and choppy, and they're put off by that. And it's colder, of course. So lots of reasons like that. But it's funny talking about limpets and Kazman, because a few of us were listened in to this conference about sort of raising the profile of British marine life. And one speaker was saying about how we must be aware that we have big charismatic animals like seals and basking sharks and so on. And of course we do. And then he said something like, oh, and we mustn't just go on about limpets or something like that. And suddenly in the chat column, all these comments started appearing. Hey, don't diss limpets. And it was really funny. And before I even had a chance to think anything, virtually, Jack Sewell at the MBA had put in the chat box, hey, limpets are cool, leave them alone. And it was really funny. I've never seen so many responses. So limpets are getting there.
When you think about marine life, you often think of like the big stuff, like you said, like cetaceans and sharks. I mean, people don't even know about sharks in England. They don't even know we have shark species.
I mean, diving, you'll only see a handful, but we've got a lot more than that. But some are open water and very shy, so you're unlikely to see. But one of the other people who's done a podcast with you is Georgie.
She's in the first episode.
And she, I remember meeting her, and sort of very similar views on things. And I remember her saying that even some of the students here that she was meeting with are very sort of focused on the big charismatic animals and tropical waters, and sort of she's, you know, even trying to tell marine biology students what they've got.
Exactly. Here. I think that's what gets you into the field of marine biology sometimes, you know, because you're interested in the big stuff. And then actually when you start digging into it, you actually see all these different things.
And I think part of what makes it so amazing is that the animals are so alien. You know, animals like starfish are just, for example, so different to us. And in a way, and this sounds heretical here, but the animals that I find also least amazing in a way are the primates. Because when you see programs about primate behavior and learn about primate behavior, they're behaving so similarly to us. You think, you know, people say, oh, isn't it amazing that they're doing X, Y, or Z? You think, well, no, not really, because that's what we do. We do. So, and it's other animals like dog whelks that you presume aren't thinking their strategy. It's hardwired. And I think that whole aspect of behavior being hardwired and acting just through natural selection rather than consciousness, who knows? More consciousness than we think, but a lot of it must be hardwired, and that blows me away.
Do you think this species, like every species, is like conscious of?
Oh, I don't know. I don't. Well, we think not, don't we?
Yeah, but from what you've observed,
I think there's certainly a lot more consciousness than we assume. And I mean, there was some work, it made the national press last year, about shore crabs showing how well they learnt in mazes. There was a lot better learning than was expected of an arthropod. And the researchers themselves were very surprised by that. So certainly more than we think.
And when did you start taking photos?
I think a first attempt sort of in about 1980 when I started snorkeling, but they were really, really bad. With a camera in a sort of glorified plastic bag, didn't really work. I then got an underwater camera and in the early 80s, one of the Nikonuses. I don't know, some of the older people listening might remember that, those, and then carried on ever since. But photography has always been a bit of a means to an end rather than an art form. I'm not a very artistic photographer. I'm sort of just functional, really. But I like photographs that tell a story, particularly of behaviour. So I love filmmaking now as well. I'm doing video.
Where can we find some of your work?
Well, there's I've got a website, marinephoto.co.uk, and linked to that I've got a Vimeo site which has sort of video clips of animal behaviour. I do a daily Instagram, Paul Naylor Marine Photo, and so put up a story often about animal behaviour, normally a still, sometimes a little video. I'm trying to build interest in that because it's a good way of getting nice stories and messages over. And if people want to see just what Teresa and I have been up to very recently, there's a new film on the Wembury Marine Centre YouTube channel called Wonderful Wembury. And it's a film, a 13-minute film about all bits of behaviour and the different habitats and so on.
If you had to give any advice to students or young people or anyone that wants to pursue a career in marine biology or as a photographer, what would you tell them?
Patience and flexibility. I do, you know, I know marine biology is a very competitive field, very difficult. I mean, look at me. I sort of, although trained as a marine biologist and my work was linked to the environment, but it wasn't pure marine biology for many decades. And I carried on the marine as a sideline. And I think talking to a lot of biologists, they've started out doing voluntary work. So, you know, you have to start out work on a voluntary basis sometimes, and that turns into a career. I think flexibility and also learning skills, not necessarily. And also, I mean, I'm probably not the best person to ask, but you certainly see people getting good opportunities, not because of the subject they've studied, particular, you know, the animal, but the technique they've used, whether it be, you know, DNA sequencing or a certain sort of computer modelling or statistics. So something that might not seem that biological, if they've built their skills, it ends up being a routine.
And what's your favourite thing about Plymouth? Why did you decide to stay here?
Oh, it was just all the sort of places nearby the coast. Well, I think when you stand on the Hoe, if you stand on the Hoe and look out at the Sound and you see sort of Mount Edgecombe on one side, Jenny Cliff Sea, and you think the city centre is sort of 5 minute walk behind me. And to be have that sort of vista that close to a city centre, I can't, you know. Is there anywhere else in Britain that's quite like that?
I don't know.
I don't.
Nice. Well, thank you, Paul. I think that's the end of the episode. But thank you a lot for taking your time to answer all my questions.
Thank you very much. Enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Paul and I, and I hope you've enjoyed it. Paul is a real inspiration. I first met him when I was in my first year at uni, and then I won one of his books, and I've always been amazed by his photos, so I'm really grateful to have had him on the podcast. If you want to know more about his work and see some of his photos, and I would highly recommend doing so, I've put some links in the description for you to check out. I hope this has inspired you to look at the sea in a different way, and you know, maybe next time you go in the water, you look for some of the blennies and other cool organisms that are found there. Thanks again for your interest in the podcast. Don't hesitate to reach out about anything and keep your eyes open for the next episode. And in the meantime, take care of yourself and of the ocean.